Hi there. You're listening to the LLB podcast, the podcast for law students and young lawyers. My name is Johnny Nguyen and I'll be your host today. Welcome to episode 16 of the podcast. Today we're hearing from Peter Domkins, an industry leader in legal innovation, transformation, and project management. We break down exactly what these terms actually mean and how they're shaping the future of the legal industry. Most importantly, though, we break down how law students and young lawyers can take leading roles in these processes to create change within their own organizations. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. We've got Peter Domkins with us here today to talk about legal innovation, legal project management, legal all things you don't really learn at university. So before we kick off, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners and custodians of the lands that I'm working, recording, living on, and that's the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. To sort of kick us off today, and I guess for background here, Peter is a director at PwC New Law, and obviously a lot of buzzwords going around here. So I might kick off with some questions to Peter about just background here. So Peter, can you tell us who you are and what you do?
Hi, Johnny, and thanks for having me on. Pleasure to be here. Right, a little bit of a who are you, what do you do kind of question. Let's launch in. That was a Narnia impersonation, by the way. I am an adjunct associate professor at UNSW Faculty of Law. I am also a director specializing in the transformation of in-house legal teams, law firms, and judicial bodies. That's what our new law team focuses on at PwC. We're full end-to-end consultants and implementation specialists. So we don't just give the advice, we stick around and actually implement it. So put your money where your mouth is when you're giving advice like that. On top of which, I've got a few other hats. I'm registered as a professional project manager in three different countries, including Chartered in the UK. I'm vice president and editor of the Journal of the Australian Society for Computers and the Law. And I'm a nationally accredited project management assessor for the Australian Institute of Project Management. So, got a few things going on, but yeah, a lot of buzzwords there. But new law, which I find always an interesting term, because suddenly it's very much Minsky's concept of a suitcase term. Minsky, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but Minsky's concept of artificial intelligence, right? If you said intelligence, it means pretty much any. It's very subjective. Hence a suitcase term. We can throw different terms into it, and all kind of collectively means intelligence. Same thing with new law, I think. You know, you've got new practitioners, very much, with new business models, they're new law. Alternative legal service providers, they're new law. You've got the big four and their end-to-end integrated offerings, they're new law. You've got traditional law who have now adopted potential new ways of working, whether they're, nearshore, captive, onshore, offshore service offerings or using LPOs themselves, they're new law. Everyone's kind of, I think almost everyone's now new law. So we might need to re-benchmark ourselves, maybe come up with newest law.
It sounds like maybe smart law might be the way to go about it too.
Talking about intelligence, right? You heard it here first.
PwC is just taking it that way. We're not new law anymore, we're smart law now. Smarter law. Sure. And so, curiously, how did you end up in PwC New Law? What was the background journey there? What sort of skills did you develop on the way that got you here?
Right. My career was certainly non-linear is maybe the nicest way to phrase that. It wasn't the traditional, summer clerkship, law, straight into top tier law firm, straight into, career, and then around the age of 30 odd got disillusioned and jumped across into something slightly different, which is a path that many have trodden before. Speaking on behalf of a friend, and so mine was finished law school, then went and worked in organizational change and project management for the better part of a decade Lived overseas, worked 3 years in the Middle East, a couple of years, had some time in Malaysia, a couple of years in London, where I actually did work finally started working as a real lawyer over in London. And when I was over there working for a Silver Circle firm, I started to work with the global head of strategy and business development, and so started in legal ops right around that 2010-2012 time, which is just when concepts like legal project management were first actually being coined and first emerging, first in the US and then the UK. So it was really right at the crest of the wave. And then short enough, returned to the fair shores here, started with another top-tier firm here as their head of legal project management and legal transformation, and you had to grow the team from scratch there, particularly around legal project management. Finally settled with my current and hopefully forever home at PwC.
Awesome. So it sounds like being at the crest of the wave, and you know, noting that, I will get you to explain a little bit more what all of those terms mean, legal project management, transformation, etc. But to sort of dive into the fact that being at the crest of the wave of, I guess, this new movement about doing law smarter, better, managing it properly, how did you gain buy-in every time that you moved to a new place? And, you know, I guess, what tips do you have for people that need to create that buy-in to actually have organizational change towards these sorts of models?
Oh, it's a great question. Because you're right. Particularly when you look at the history of our profession, as a guild, really, started off as the archetypical profession. From 300 odd years now. We are very much a profession that is resistant, that has been resistant to change. We have seen more change in the past decade than we have in the past 300 odd years. Technologically driven, socially driven, it's been brilliant. But you are still dealing oftentimes with legacy resistance to change. So it's a fair question about how do you land in a new place, which might have a culture which and perceptions which aren't aligned with what you've been asked to achieve or what you're trying to achieve. And so a few key skills will be, it all centers around change management. Let's start with that. When I hired, hiring in for in my current team or previous teams, let's say legal project managers, they'd come into the interview expecting to talk about project management. That's good. Let's talk about that for a little bit. But what I really want to talk about is change management. Because it doesn't matter how good the product you've got is. If you can't sell it and no one wants to buy it, it doesn't really matter. So change management was where, for me, it was at. And a few practical tips for those to answer your question directly about joining a new organization. Critical is establishing buy-in through demonstrating value. Quickly try and demonstrate value. That means identifying the quick wins, the low-hanging fruit. I've heard it also described as the tall trees, whatever cute metaphor you like to come up with, but finding those quick wins, the things which, if you're going to put it in the 2x2 quadrant of value versus effort, we're a consultant here, of course, trust the consultants to come up with a 2x2 matrix, right? But if you look at it in that quadrant, what you're really after are the low effort, high value, right? That's the territory where you're really now. Oftentimes, also people are a little bit deluded when they put things in there because they, this is the project manager and you're coming out. It's like you suddenly say, "Oh, okay, yeah, that's not that much effort." We'll start getting into cognitive biases maybe in this conversation, but we are a flawed species when it comes to human decision making, we're impacted by a lot of cognitive biases, including optimism bias, which is the tendency to overestimate the benefits and underestimate the impact, the negative consequences, the time to deliver it. So with that said, enough qualifications suggesting that start with the easy wins, but that's where you want to really look at. Because as and there's many models of change out there, organizational change, that is, but a big part is gaining buy-in at the end of the day. Organizations are made of people. They're processes, sure, but they're processes enacted by people. Particularly in professional services. In other types of services, they try and automate humans out of the loop, particularly in manufacturing and other pharmaceutical, I imagine. Like, if it enters a production environment, you actually exactly try and take a human out of the loop to try and optimize it. But in the other circumstance, you've got humans. And that means you've got to convince them to do things, which is then where the change management part comes in. And the way that people get most motivated to do things is when it's in their self-interest. Never underestimate the power of self-interest. So you might come up with some grand wars. We're going to change the world. We're going to do this. Yeah, we're going to do it. But unless they can see how it directly benefits them personally, unless there's a, you might have this burning platform. Well, the CEO wants to do it. It's obvious we need to change. It's obvious we need to automate and put in place these document automated documents. It's clear that we need to start outsourcing this low-value work offshore or near shore. But that might make the job for the individual lawyer themselves. They might think, well, that's a bit hard. I'm going to have to learn a new tech. I'm going to have to change behaviors that I'm used to. I'm going to have to lose cozy relationships that I've got with my... There might be a whole bunch of reasons in their head, very subjective, that make them resistant. So finding the wins which help individuals is critical. And that's really where things like design thinking come in terms of, as a process for innovation, starting with why and starting with understanding the end user's problem as a starting point rather than you coming in and telling them what needs to be done.
Cool. Design thinking and, I guess, innovation at this point is probably a good point to pivot to the general concepts that we're talking about here. So I know as a uni student, I had no exposure to any of these concepts, but, we've thrown out a couple of terms here, legal innovation, legal project management, legal transformation. I guess, can you give us a quick rundown of what those mean? And more broadly, are those categories and labels useful for a uni student understanding the various types of things that need to happen? Like, are they actually meaningful labels, or are they just terms?
Oh, I love that. Yes. It reminds me that when legal project management was first starting out, like I said, it only got coined about 2010 or so. It was first, might have been a little bit before then coined, but it was first published in The American Lawyer in 2010, so kind of first popularized. And there are a couple of articles, as always, comes out, you're railing against this new thing. And someone was suggesting, why are we calling it legal project management? It's not like the lawyer picks up their legal telephone and types an email on their legal computer, like the bat phone or something, right? It's like, it's not like it answers the legal laptop, in their legal home. It's like, the drive to put the term legal in front of everything and to make it special. And so there was a little bit of a pushback for that. And so when you read out that, legal operations, legal project management, legal transformation, okay. But these terms actually do mean something. And putting the term legal in front actually does have an impact. I'll explain it for you. So let's just start off with some of these terms, innovation more broadly. When you look at the dictionary definition, it's basically just bringing ideas together or things together in a novel, interesting, unforeseen way, but usually it's directed. It's to solve a problem. It's not just bringing things randomly together for the sake of it. That's I think we're starting to get into the realms then of art, so doing something for its own beauty and its own volition. Normally, businesses in particular have an objective in mind, unless they're in pure research, maybe in academia, or that there may be at the front end of technology, and they're happy to have those those think tanks and those R&D facilities that just play. Outside of that, normally innovation is directed towards a purpose. And there's a fair bit of the literature out which suggests that that purpose should be directed towards creating client value. And on the whole, I think that's a pretty good direction. As a firm, as a corporate, and it lines up beautifully with what I mentioned just about design thinking in terms of starting with the end user's needs first, starting off with the client need first, and then solving for that rather than solving for the law firm thinks the problem. This is their clients, and innovate to make the delivery of law as a service better for them. And that's just a little point I want to make in terms of delivery of law as a service, because when you're at law school, you get taught black letter law. As we all, I'm a lawyer myself. We all went through it. All the pre-C-Lit and it's all the fan favorites of admin and constitutional law and real property. I'm sure I'm already giving some of our listeners PTSD just listing them out, so I'll stop. But admin, gosh, I had like 2-hour tutes Monday, Wednesday, 9 a.m., 2 hours admin. That's when you know you're committed, turning up to 9 a.m. to our admin class. But but it was a very, those areas were black letter law. They didn't really kind of talk about the service of law or the delivery of law as a service. So similar, no different to a doctor being able to diagnose a patient's concerns and diagnose what the problem is. Oftentimes a lawyer, put it this way, the clients don't neatly present with their problems on a page, neatly distilled by clear legal issues, going, oh, okay, I'm good. This is what I want to solve. Yeah, these are the things that are obviously the problem. No, they come with saying, I'm in trouble, or I have a problem, help.
You know what's odd, though? It's interesting that you mentioned that relationship, that analogy to the medical profession, because at least to my understanding, like I study on a campus that's full of med students at Western Sydney Campbelltown, and it looks like when they're in training, they do a lot of, like, they don't get presented with a page of symptoms that they then diagnose, right? Like, law students get a neat page of facts that are undisputed, which, you know, in real life is often unheard of. You don't ever get anyone that comes in with a list of facts, but, law students do. Whereas medical students are often like, oh, go into, like, practice, have clinical assessments where you're literally talking to humans and trying to find out what their issue is. So by some odd, I don't know, somehow we've ended up with law students that are less capable of diagnosing the issue than med students, which I think they're equally as necessary in either field.
Absolutely. You know, I think it's just also, it's just the nature of our profession, how we grew, right? I did mention earlier we started off as a guild. It's very much, we learn, it's a vocation-based profession. You learn on the job, you learn doing. There was significant information asymmetry. And most of that knowledge was jealously guarded, as in the best guises of a profession. Yeah, a traditional profession, knowledge is guarded and not shared. Otherwise, obviously, to share the information would be to lose the power of the profession. So it's actually been a great equalization over the past couple of years. You've seen that information asymmetry change. But you end up with lawyers. For example, I studied contract law and then advanced contract law, and never saw a contract all of university, which is insane. Right? Yeah, if you want to be a little bit practical about it. Then I wanted to just on that, because I wanted to kind of pivot back to your earlier question. Me being doing my best politician there and just jumping around, but not answering the actual question. So let's go back to the exam question. So it was originally around innovation. And then what is, let's say, project management and organizational change and legal operations. I'll take you through a couple of those as well. Legal project management. It starts off with project management. So project management, you're probably thinking something like, construction. You're thinking, hard hat, high-vis, work, tradies on a building site kind of deal. Project engineering maybe, project management. And that's true. That's great. That's where project management does, originally it stemmed, arguably in its current form, back to the 60s, which is when the project management body of knowledge was first formulated. But then well before then, like the Gantt chart was actually developed by someone called Gantt back in the early 1900s. And arguably people have been building things a lot earlier than then with a degree of project management, like the pyramids. People have been building things for some time and there's still this test of time. So project management principles, been around some time. Tried, tested. They're basically a grab bag of best practices to try and make sure that projects are delivered in a more than not successful manner and to be able to replicate that success. That's what they are. They're just best practice means of risk mitigation at the end of the day. Because when you look at it, it includes things like such a random grab bag of stuff. You've got planning, budgeting, scheduling, risk management, quality assurance, teams, like all the communications and stakeholders. It's like you've got half the arts faculty involved in this. Like, what's going on? Social sciences, math, like, so it's a grab bag of stuff, but it's a useful grab bag. So when we say legal project management, what are we doing? We're taking some of those processes, best practice processes, and adapting them for legal services. The main difference is that in a construction environment, you have a lot of processes in place, like best practice project management. Project management body of knowledge has 49 separate sub-processes and plans split over five phases of initiating, planning, implementing, reporting, which is basically monitoring, controlling, and close out, right? 49 separate sub-processes, and each of them has many, many more sub-processes. Now, that works because you've got resources tied to each of those processes. So you have a schedule, and you have a team of schedulers who update it. You have a risk matrix, and you have a risk officer. You have a overall program plan and a program director. You've got resources and artifacts or processes and documents all matched up one-to-one, which is great and works really well. Of course, there's a problem. In the legal sector, we don't have that kind of additional resource to do all those extra plans. You know, the lawyer is building the car and driving it at the same time. They don't have time to, so for me to go to a lawyer and say, hey, yeah, you're already working at 120% utilization. Can you take out the extra 10 to 15% of your time on top of this somehow and then just fill in plans to make me happy? They're going to be colourful with their language. And so you're going to, so I can't go to them and say, fill in all these documents. I'm going to have to right size it, fit for purpose for the project at hand. And that usually goes around some of the core stuff. You know, have you got a work breakdown structure, i.e. have you just figured out what are the kind of the key overall steps to get to where you want to get to? Have you defined that and who's responsible for them and broadly when they're due? Have you figured out who your team is? And have you made it clear to the team where they're going, that they are a team and what we're trying to achieve? Have you actually figured out what the constraints on the project are? So is the client guided most by time concerns or cost concerns or quality concerns? Yeah, and then you've got something called the triple constraint, which looks at those three and works out that, okay, well, where am I going to put my, where's my effort go? Is it an absolute deadline we can't miss? Or have we got some time on the deadline, but they're actually really cost constrained? Yeah, but understanding that, what success looks like for the client, and then delivering to that, really important. So that's what legal project management is. Legal operations, really important. In a private practice environment, so a law firm environment, you'll have, depending upon the size of the firm, you'll have a number of back office support staff. So you'll have maybe a CFO, chief financial officer. You might have someone in charge of HR, human people. You might have someone in charge of marketing or a whole team, depending upon how big the organization is. You might even have a COO to look after all of that. And that in a law firm, they would refer to as the back office. Now, in a in-house legal team, they still have, some needs. They'll have IT needs. They'll have, they need someone to figure out, okay, what their knowledge and learning requirements are. They'll have to need someone to work out, maybe we do want to automate processes. Who's going to look at that? Who's going to lead that change program? But the thing is, the legal in-house legal teams don't have their own entire back office support function looking after them. They themselves are back office support for the business, right? So who's looking after the lawyers in that environment? Which is why now this has seen over the past 5 years in particular, the rapid growth of something called the legal operations professional, who sits in as part of an in-house legal team and effectively is a bit of a transformation and change agent who can take on all different aspects of legal operations. Maybe it's improving the billing. Maybe it's looking at their, their team structure, how their teams are structured, their ways of working. Maybe it's looking at project management. It could be looking at document automation or improving how they engage external law firms and panel reviews and outsourcing to alternative legal service providers. It could be any range of things that the legal operations person looks at, but that's their job, to help transform and improve the performance of the in-house legal team. So hopefully that kind of takes you through, walks you through some of the terms, a bit of a buzzword bingo, some of the key terms that are bouncing around in the market at the moment.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. And I think all those terms have given a lot of practical insight to junior listeners that might not have been exposed to what you call law as a service, right? I think we get exposed to law as as you've said in the past at some point, law is an intellectual endeavor, but not so much a service, right? And so I think we can see a common theme here, though, that across all these things that we do, the underlying theme is that we're doing it to achieve a better outcome of some kind. So, you said legal innovation is directed. It's not just for the sake of it. It's not art, right? It's legal innovation for usually commercial outcomes. And so with that in mind, what is the key driver for innovation? How do we achieve innovation? And I'll take you back to some conversations we've had in the past about psychological safety and how that might play a role in innovation.
Oh, love the setup. The key to it is trust. There are plenty of studies which substantiate that a key driver of high-performing self-managed work teams is trust. If you look at Tuckman's model of team formation, you might have heard, maybe some of the listeners have heard of it, forming, storming, norming, performing, and sometimes there's the fifth one, adjourning or mourning, which sounds a little macabre, so I never really kind of touched on that one. This is team closeout, right? But you've got the first four stages. In particular, and for me, it's really focusing on the first two, the forming and the storming part. Because when you've got a team, and people make this assumption that because they're okay, that's because we're all in the same organization where we can just naturally fit together and work together as Lego, like Lego. Now, it doesn't quite work that way. Even if we're in the same organization, the same law firm, the same legal team, same business, when you've grumped people together, that's what they are. They're a collection of individuals. They're not a team at that point in time. You might know why they're there, but they don't. So your job as a team leader is to provide that direction. Why are we here? What are we trying to achieve? And so you provide that shared vision and kind of set some expectations around what we're trying to do. And then importantly, you put in place what I refer to a communication and governance structure. How is the team going to relate to each other? Who's in charge? Who makes decisions? If there's a disagreement, how do we resolve it? Critical. People just, we just want to be in packs. We just want to work out where are we going, who's in charge, what are we trying to do? Great. Okay, now I understand what I'm trying to do and how I fit in. If we don't spend time doing that, the teams will spend a lot of time bouncing around in circles, tripping over each other's feet. Yeah, there'll be gaps and overlaps where either people aren't looking at something or multiple people look at the same thing. There'll be disagreements, there'll be power plays, all of the worst aspects of corporate and organizational behavior, all has come to life when we could have solved it in 5 minutes at the kickoff meeting at the start, just going, this is what we're doing, this is how we resolve, this is who's in charge, this is how we communicate with each other, this is how we relate to each other, and we can quickly get onto and that basically establishes a degree of trust between each other, because then we can, I can trust you to basically within your boundaries, I can trust you to act in an expected way. Now, there's a, we're as a profession, have been, known potentially as a bit of a low trust profession. When you look at psychological studies of lawyers, they're definitely at the lower end of the scale of trust. It's kind of not helped by eat what you can kill approaches, a private practice to a degree. I actually think it extends all the way from law school, right? Because we're such competitive, we're competitive beasts in law school. We all pitted against each other. It's the nature of the system. We're told to not, we're told to, very much run your own race and stay in your own lane. To look at what someone else is doing is called cheating. And then suddenly you step into the workplace and suddenly it's called collaboration and suddenly you're meant to do it. Somehow unwinding a decade plus worth of education, which has been exactly the opposite. Run your own race. Don't collaborate. It's called cheating. Now suddenly you've got to collaborate. So it takes some time to unwind some of those behaviors. And some people just don't get there at all. But we are it's a low trust. The law itself also doesn't necessarily reward a hero. People don't necessarily want the happy-go-lucky, Happy Gilmore kind of lawyer. The lawyers are expected to be, being a bit low trust actually can help with some good lawyering, not necessarily accepting things on face value, uncovering risks, being persistent, really trying to get to the underlying reason and truth of things.
It seems to go hand in hand with the work generally, though. Like, a good lawyer shouldn't necessarily trust even the client or anything that anyone says, right? Like, you're literally being trained to spot risks and issues that might not be on the surface. So it makes sense what you're saying.
Totally. It makes for a great lawyer. It doesn't make for a great team member or a great innovator or a great collaborator. So there's got to be a happy middle. right? I'm a big fan of, you know, the extremes in all ways are bad. You know, let's just try and find, there's got to be a way in which we can kind of, find a path through. Because I think we do need to do it. You know, we're a cycle. So psychological safety, which is a big part of building trust, is such a critical part of our profession. I'm so glad that it's starting to get, much more head of steam over the past, over the past few years. We are known as the burnout profession. There was an article actually in the Law Society Journal, about a year or so ago, which talked about the costs of, a psychological safety, or the impacts of a lack of psychological safety. It had crazy figures in there. Like 33% of lawyers were suffering disability and distress due to depression. 40% of lawyers felt they were likely or very likely to leave their current firms in the next year. Such churn. Even outside of legal, total stress-related burnout costs to Australian businesses each year, nearly $11 billion. Right, so a really big impact of, like, not just in terms of you lose the, the high-performing aspects of your team because you don't have trust, but actually there are other broader impacts in not having this psychological safety and this degree of trust amongst the team. There's a great article by, some YouTube stuff by Amy Edmondson. She's got some great stuff on YouTube, which talks about, what psychologically safe teams look and feel like. And there are some questions you can ask yourself, Do I feel comfortable asking for help? Am I able to take risks? Will I be judged for making a mistake? One of those risks doesn't play out. Am my team going to support me or are they going to undermine me? Is it going to be really competitive? Are my unique talents valued? Am I valued for the differences that I make? Can I mention and raise difficult problems? These are some critical questions that you need to be able to, and hopefully you can answer them in the affirmative. And if you can, you're very much in a psychologically safe team, which is brilliant because that, as mentioned, is really conducive to trust building. And then we can really crack on getting through those storming natures of a team and really get into the to the performing, high-performing aspects of a team. You might ask, that's all well and good for me to say all these things, but what do you do if you're a junior lawyer joining a team?
Yeah, I was about to ask, what we've heard so far is sort of, a top-down approach to setting the avenue for conflict resolution and role allocation, but what about a bottoms-up approach? How do juniors engage that change?
Yeah, how do you manage up? Right, it's easy to manage down, and that's easy enough to create that. If you're managing down, that's great. Gandhi quote of be the change you want to see, right? So you can create this culture. Now, bearing in mind that you can have great team culture within a more acerbic and not as conducive organizational culture, or you can have a great organizational culture and still have quite a aggressive team culture. But you can control what's in you can impact what's within your immediate control. So if you are lucky enough to be managing others, yes, by all means. Create the space where it's okay for people to ask. But if you're finding yourself, particularly as an early stage career professional or someone joining a team, and you want to help create the create this kind of culture, there's a couple of ways. One of the most effective ways, and it's a real kind of under the radar approach, draws off one of the concepts from project management. There's a technique in project management referred to as agile. That's another buzzword you'll hear a lot about. Agile with a capital A is a software development methodology. So it's a project management methodology for how to deliver software. First codified in the 2000s. Very good. They've got terms like sprints and scrum masters, and there's a whole little lexicon there. But really at its heart, it's talking about iterative emergent planning. Agile is, as a concept, lowercase a, agile, really good for trying to, if you don't have high degrees of certainty about what the scope looks like, what the final objective of what you're trying to deliver looks like. So it's either the house with these precise specifications, or maybe in legal terms, it's I need this suite of 13 documents precisely because I want to achieve this particular transaction. Right? That's a very clear outcome. Great, then you can plan for that up front, put all the planning in, and then deliver against the outcomes. But where you don't really know how you're going to get there, like litigation, classic example, that's like you're building the house and you've also got a team next door who's trying to bomb it, right? So it's constantly changing. So how do we design it? Let's put a wing there. Nope, they just created that. Okay, let's put a wing over here. Yeah, it's the you're constantly trying to plan on the go. And that's really where agile approaches are really good, because they're much more incremental planning. You know, you've got a horizon of certainty. All right, so we'll plan for the next month, and then and then periscope up, figure out whether still got it in the right direction, and then continue. But from agile, one of the key concepts they've got is a concept of a retro, short for retrospective. It's a concept where you have a lessons learned. So we have a review of what's going well, what's not going well, and what are we doing that could go better. But instead of having it at the very end of the project, what we do is we have it, say, midway through the project. That means that we've actually can course correct, rather than just waiting until the very end when everything's like, oh, that was a bit crap. All right, we'll do better next time. I'd rather have that conversation when we're actually in the project. So instead of it, let's fix the problem now, right? Why wait till the end? And you ask questions really linked to some of the psychological safety stuff. You know, does everyone understand what's going on? Yeah, how are we collaborating and communicating changes? How are we onboarding new team members? Are we happy with the team culture? Have we received any client feedback? If so, what is it? And my favorite one, is everyone okay? Because we've got Are You Okay Days, and as a profession and as more broadly, I think it's a brilliant concept, really behind it. But of course, it's one day a year. And for the 360-odd other days a year, it's get back to work. But for one day, it's Are You Okay? Cool. All right, get back to your 80-hour week. I'd rather have, instead of having this one day a year, let's build it into our regular cadence. Let's build it into how we work. Build it into these questions as part of the retros. Are we okay? And I think, now we can kind of look back at the impacts of things like this recent slew of raw commissions that we had and the impact that had, particularly in the mid-tier and top-tier legal market. There was a lot of burnout from that. And I think that question wasn't being asked often enough. Are we okay? Yeah, and having genuine conversations about it. So this health check is a great way to bring it back to juniors to ask. Yeah, and it can do it under the guise of, hey, let's be innovative. I've heard about this really cool thing. We can do a project management. But the trick to this retro is to make sure that it's done in a psychologically safe environment, right? It's meant to be a space where you can actually have an opinion. Have it as your own opinion. Important. Speak to your own truth. Try not to lay into one person. It's like, oh, it's all bloody Sam's fault from accounts. Yeah, try not to, try and be a bit more constructive with it. But it's meant to be a safe place where the team can constructively talk about, some of the stuff which otherwise might not get talked about. I don't feel that I'm getting the kind of information I need. I feel a little bit left out. I feel that stuff, which is the kind of the underlying grit of what helps teams work together, that trust. This is how you can really help form it and start to create the culture that you want in a team.
Yeah, and it's very much aligned with, I guess, the name of being agile, right? I think the whole point of that retro seems to be to gather information quickly and be able to adapt to it rather than, doing it at the very end of the project where at that point it's too late to implement a lot of the changes. It, oddly enough, it reminds me of a TED talk where I think someone linked how quickly issues are raised to two odd metrics, but like very fitting. I think rates of couples getting divorced and rates that nations go to war with each other. Like the faster you raise issues, the less likely you are to get divorced / go to war. And the longer issues stew and stay under the radar, the more likely it is.
Totally. Because they get entrenched positions. Right. Mm. Instead of, you start to, and it's like that you start seeing the people start seeing the world from their own perspective and only their perspective. Now, all of these processes around innovation, design thinking are all designed around, particularly design thinking, it's called the double diamonds, right? That you go out wide to start off with before you even start trying to find the solution, you start defining the problem. And to define the problem, you hear it from other people's perspectives. That is absolutely critical. It's just very much a kind of a reach out and integrate. In fact, there's a really nice dovetail with a best practice approach to crisis management by NASA. This is actually from a person who was a in charge of mission control, former person was in charge of mission control at NASA. So very good at dealing with a crisis. But one of their key adages was, get more data. We can always panic later, right? So how do you solve a crisis? Get more information. You actually reach out, which is interesting because what happens, again, NASA studies, when people are under stress, two things happen, or a couple of things happen. One, high stress, people lose, on average, 15 points of IQ, which is crazy, right?
So there's actually... Like we can all attest to that in an interview, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. So cognitive impairment, which is interesting because lawyers rely upon that superpower to get them through. Lawyers overcome poor planning with intellectual horsepower. They've got that strength. And just when they need their superpower, it abandons them. But other things that happen is under stress, we task shed, we get rid of stuff. It's like, don't come to me, I'm too busy. And also we become a little more emotional and a little bit more narky. We don't invest time into other people and into the team building behaviors. But in particular, we kind of shut down, we pull down the shutters and we don't want more information. So that's the psychological impact of stress. And lawyers, as we've been saying, live under stress as kind of a constant state of being for a degree. So we need, just in that time, we need to train ourselves actually to reach out and to get more information, to be more inclusive rather than the other way around.
Okay, Peter. So to sort of wrap the substantive portion of this chat up then, I guess pivoting away from legal transformation as a discussion here, but if a listener is really interested in joining that sort of work, they've heard it and they're like, I want to work there now. How do we actually get there, right? Because commercial careers very clearly set out, as you said, clerkship, associate, whatever, right? But legal innovation, legal transformation, this whole sector seems quite unknown to the uni student's mind. Where can we learn more here?
Oh, great. So there's a couple of things they can do straight away. So there's organisations like the Legal Forecast, for example, which do have a presence on a lot of Australian university campuses. And so they're in each state. They're great. Their affiliation or their grouping of like-minded university students, not just law students. You have computer science students, all-minded. And early-stage career professionals, and again, not just legal. But they are focused somewhat on legal, the Legal Forecast. But they're very much the intersection of law, change, innovation, societal transformation. Real interesting group. So you can reach out to some of them and just start attending some of their events and understand what they're doing. You've also got a bunch of resources online. Often look up your local, your relevant state law society. So in New South Wales, it's called FLIP, Future of Law in the Profession. They've got a bunch of resources online for free. The same for Law Institute Victoria, Western Australia. So they're great resources just to kind of get a grounding in terms of what are the latest innovationist trends. A lot of these have, like FLIP, for example, have what they call irregular buzzwords. In fact, I just presented on one just the other week on data. So where we have a couple of industry panelists, leaders come in and talk on a particular topic for an hour or so. It's easy enough to register and attend those. Plenty of other organisations like CLOC, for example, the Corporate Legal Operations Consortium, CLOC, have a look at their website. They've really come to strength in the past 5 or so years, where they're dedicated to looking at legal operations professionals for in-house legal corporate teams. You've also got at university, a lot of universities are now they can't affect the original Priestley 11, that's mandated by regulation and statute, but they can certainly, a lot of universities are offering elective courses in this area now, on a range of areas, whether it's transformation or coding, for example. So definitely, if you've got a chance to do one of those electives, do it. It's being built into increasingly into the mandatory thing you have to do after your law degree, so often, College of Law here in New South Wales, but equally so, there are other alternatives to College of Law, including what UNSW are doing. It's a graduate diploma in legal professional practice, which is basically what you're getting when you attend one of these. Some universities, like UTS, I think, have actually that equivalent built into their law degree. But where, for example, with the UNSW equivalent, we're now building some of this content directly into that. So they actually get, as part of their formal education, at least made aware of some of these issues. So there's a couple of ways, you know, a whole bunch of resources. Also, you know, some of the other thought leaders, Susskind, Professor Richard Susskind, Mitch Kowalski, Mark Cohen. So these are some great, you know, regular publishers on Forbes. Definitely have a look at some of those thought leaders and see what they're writing. This is a great place to start. And if you want to get a little bit more, you know, that's almost like just to see if it's for you, you know, if you're interested in it. And if you are, then the next step is, I think, to possibly also consider getting some, you know, some training or even, dare say, some qualifications in the area, whether it's doing a design thinking course, whether it's doing a project management course, whether it's doing a change management course, you know, something. So that way, when you come into the table, when you're applying for these roles in legal ops, you're not just a, hey, I'm a law student and I've got a law degree along with all the other law students and their law degrees. I'm interested in this new area, but I've got zero training or zero experience in it. Yeah, that's not a great sales pitch to open the door. So just as it's competitive to get into legal, equally so, and you want to have, you know, great marks and, you know, show your creds. Same deal with legal ops. At least have done, you know, shown interest in it. You know, the fact that you can then talk to, no, I've been involved in a couple of hackathons through the legal forecast. I've attended, you know, read these resources around Flip. I went and got, you know, I've got certified, or I've got some initial training in change management and design thinking. You know, that come to the table with something. Or continuous improvement is a really useful one, something like around Lean or Six Sigma. That come to the table with something more than just legal is a great way to actually get your foot in the door. Because at the end of the day, you know, it's one of those catch-22 scenarios, which are so annoying, I know. Like, you know, you need the experience to get the job. But doing these other things, I think, get you at least, you know, start to get you out of first gear and into second and third gear in legal ops. And, you know, you can start to have a constructive conversation with people who are hiring, because ultimately they're looking for someone who can add value straight away. Going back to what we first said about the how do you start this stuff? You add value. You know, it's a lot easier as a hiring decision and someone that makes these kind of hiring decisions. If we've got someone that I know, you know, from day one, yes, they'll need training and support, but I can see how they can already, you know, start running. And there's certain things I can get them start doing straight away. That's a compelling proposition.
Definitely. And thank you for all those resources. You can see that I think you've given quite a range of resources for the law student from, the moment they start considering legal tech to the point to which they want to get in the door. So I'll put links to all of that on the screen and also in the description. Last question here today then. I guess, Peter, how can listeners, if they're listening and they're interested in connecting with you, how can they reach out to you? What can they talk about? How do we do this here?
All right, easy. So LinkedIn, I'm on LinkedIn. That's where, you know, it's Facebook for professionals, right? So that's where I live. I have a Twitter presence, Project Pete 4. I'm trying to hunt down the other three because there can be only one. We'll see. Project Pete 4, but mainly LinkedIn. In terms of stuff to talk to me about, so have a look at the Australian Society for Computers and Law. Like, you know, have a look at some of our events. We've got a lot of events on all the time. Attending some of them are great as a way to kind of get up to speed on current trends and issues. We've even got a journal, which I'm managing editor of. It's actually going to be a student contribution part. So think about how you might want to contribute to that maybe. But at the moment, one of the key areas we're looking at is around data and metrics. How can law firms and in-house legal teams and general counsel make more informed, data-informed strategic and tactical decisions? Moving from kind of reactive, looking at existing data, more predictive analytics. You know, where are the risks going to be? What action can I take today that will prevent a risk tomorrow? Now, that starts to get into, that's a very insightful and interesting world. And how can legal teams, particularly in-house legal teams, use, because they sit on a wealth of data. You know, all the data contained in the contracts, all the data contained in their agreements. You know, they sit on that data. How can we start to actually also understand better trends in that data? Good example is oftentimes in organizations that have that manage complaints or disputes. Maybe it's an insurance company, maybe it's even a lot, you know, maybe it might be a large service provider like a telco or something. You know, they'll have teams of people that, you know, people are, you know, unhappy with this, you know, they might have a complaint or they might be seeking a claim. How could AdNull have data then on what claims, what are the type of claims, what are the trends? Legal teams often see that and can then actually provide that information back to the people that it's the underwriters or the people that are drafting the contracts to better sharpen up their terms or address their, we're exposed to a lot of risk here. Maybe we can adjust our terms accordingly. The lawyers have a lot of ability to add value, real value to the business. So these are some of the areas that are really foremost in our mind at the moment in helping legal teams and law firms transition, along with just the broader digitization remit. All things metrics data, data visualizations is really an interest of mine and of the team at the moment.
Fantastic. And I mean, beyond the LinkedIn request, I think students should probably take note of that for the interview as well. It sounds like, to be honest, data and metrics is probably the conversation of the decade at this point, not just for legal, but I think every business out there right now is dealing with issues of data and metrics. And so I think that's a good point to wrap up on and some great actionable tips and general clarity on what legal innovation and, again, the whole suite, won't repeat the whole thing, but all of those concepts that we've dealt with today. So, Peter, thanks so much for coming onto the podcast. It's been great having you here. It's been great chatting, and thank you for being so generous with your time.
Joining in, absolute pleasure. Thanks very much.